Accession number 10295, Rule 7.
Mr. Lynn, Rule 7. You're going to say something about Dewey.
It was only left-hand Dewey. He was one of the descendants of the whiskey barons, you know, the people who brewed the whiskey up in Scotland. Another man born with a silver spoon in his mouth, but still, he was a good guy. He was quite good. Stood up well in the prison camps. Stood up very well. But as I say, we landed then into the pineapple factory. It was between 9 and 10 at night. And I forget who it was now. I think it was Lieutenant Perez. But one of the officers came in.
Lieutenant who?
Perez. P-E-R-E-Z. I think he was of Spanish descent. I'm not sure. He looked like a Spaniard anyway. And he came into the pineapple factory and said he wanted some men to go down to the Singapore Swimming Club to destroy all the spirits, etc. So a gang of them got together and went down to the Singapore Swimming Club. By this time, the Japs had got the island completely surrounded. You know, there was no way anybody was going to move out other than singly. You could probably get through the lines that way. And then from the pineapple factory opposite, I think it's still there today as a historical thing, was a kampong, Chinese Malay kampong. And as these lads went down to go to the swimming club, I joined in with two lads, Geraghty and Hennessy. Geraghty lived in Withenshaw. He died recently. Hennessy was from, I think, Leicester area. He was mean. He was one of the most meanest bloody men you could wish to meet. And by mean, I mean, he'd kill you for a half a cigarette. But these were the type of lads. I knew them. You know, we'd grown up together. We'd been in the army together. He wasn't mean to me. But, you know, if you asked him to do something, he would do it. And there was me, Hennessy, Geraghty, and another lad called McDonnell. And I think Ozzy Chamberlain was with us. And we went over the road, went out of the pineapple factory. They said, if they're going to destroy and whiskey down at the swimming club, we'll go to one of the clubs that we know and we'll have a drink. You know, so we crossed the road and was going through this kampong. And we came to one of the huts and there's a bit of noise going on, singing and one thing or another. And I pulled up. I was at the side of the hut anyway. I think I was having a pee. You know, I was having a slash. And all of a sudden someone came out of the hut with just trousers on and putties. But nothing on top, no hat, no shirt, anything like that, bare. And he came up and stood at the side of me and started yattering away in Chinese or whatever. I'd never heard Japanese before. And he started having a pee at the side of me. And then all of a sudden, Hennessy come out of the hut, came running out to this bloke who was having a pee at the side of me, and he put his knife straight into him, like that. And as he went down, he stuck his knife in his backside. I don't know why. It was a Jap. And they'd come down, and same as us, they'd gone scouting for, you know, women and drink or whatever. And Hennessy was calling me all the so-and-so's under the sun. I can't use army language, but he was calling me all the names under the sun. I should have known he was a Jap. I should have got my knife in first, you know. But the knife was, it's a bayonet. You know, an action bayonet, not the dress bayonets that you have nowadays. They only have got about 9-inch blade. You know, but they do kill. And I went following him into the hut. And in the hut, just as we got in, there was two shots. And I looked over and there's a bed. And on the bed was a girl. She was stripped off. And over the top of her was a Japanese, I don't know his officer, sergeant or what. But one of higher rank in the corps. He was either preparing to get on the girl or he was on her or whatever. And Geraghty had shot him. And in the other corner was an old woman. And the Jap who I'd been, or had come out to me, apparently, was trying to have it, had been trying to have it off with this old woman. You know, so he was dead outside and they shot this one. And then I think it was Ossie Chamberlain, he said, come on, let's get the hell out of here. Funny, stronger language than that. And
what
we run.
What was the girl doing?
The girl, she'd been held down by the Japs. He was going to have intercourse with her, or, you know, rape her, whatever.
She
was crying. Oh, she was conscious and she was crying and screaming. She was hysterical. But there's nothing, we know time for that. Because while she's making a noise, somebody's going to come and find us. You know, so we, Chamberlain just said, let's get out, come on quick, everybody. And we shot out.
This was a Chinese family, was it?
Yeah. So I made it to the main road. And as I got to the main road, there was a half track coming down. And in it was a lad called Nipakusik.
Called what?
Nipakusik. One of the battalion boxers. I don't know if he's a relation to Jackie Cusick, you know, or Johnny Cusick, the welterweight boxer. But he was a boxer as well. And he came down with his half track and I jumped on board. And he was going down to Singapore, swimming club. So I'm on board and stayed with him. And got down to the Singapore swimming club and you never saw anything like it in your life. There was men drunk, absolutely steamed out of their bloody minds, throwing whiskey at one another. It was pouring all along the floor and the carpets and everywhere. There's other blokes coming in, wadded up with the money. They've been to the bank. They've blown the bank, you know, taken all the money out of the bank. You could build a house with the notes that they've got. I don't mean pay for one to be built. I mean build one with the blocks of money that they'd lose it out of the bank. Watches, you name it, those lads had it.
Who are these people?
Australians, English, Chinese, Malay, anybody who was down in Singapore at that time just looted it. They took everything they wanted out of it.
Soldiers and civilians?
Well, I don't think that many civilians did it, tried it on, because the soldiers would have shot them anyway. If they had done, the soldiers would have taken it off them. No, it was soldiers. They was absolutely paralytic drunk and gloating over everything they'd got. It was of no use to them. They didn't know that then, but it was of no use to them. Singapore Swimming Club, the sea outside there, was just littered with it. There was bottles, money, you name it, anything. Clothing, handbags, swimming costumes, bodies. It just, you know, it stank a bit. And it was only...
Which day was this?
On the 15th of February, when we finished. On the Sunday the 15th.
And that was also the day when you killed the Japanese?
Yeah.
Or when your comrades killed the Japanese?
Mm-hmm. But the day before that was when we'd escaped, not escaped, we'd assisted, it was either the day before, 2 days before, we'd assisted Bennett, Major General Gordon Bennett. He wanted an escort from top end of Singapore through to where the seaplanes left from. I think his intention was to go on the seaplanes. And we had to give him an escort down there.
Who was that who gave him the escort exactly?
Manchester Regiment.
But which particular troops from the regiment?
From the battalion of the Manchester Regiment. There's me, Ossie Chamberlain, Churchill. I'm not sure whether young Davis, that's a D company, was in it.
So just a handful?
Yeah. It was just a 1,500 weight truck. And he was in front on another 1,500 weight truck. And in front of him was another 1,500 weight truck with another unit of 5 or 6 men. And we were giving him safe conduct through to the seaplane area. And as he went down, there's all the tram lines, you know, the wires, all the telegraph wires, everything, was all strangled all over the street. And as you went through them on your 1,500 weight, occasionally you get the sparks flying from the electrics. And he had said then, if anybody wants to come with me, come on. You know, more or less it's all over. And I was all for, but Ossie Chamberlain said, if you move one foot out of this bloody wagon, I'll kill you. And I wasn't allowed to join him.
Why do you think he said that?
Because he knew that he was going away. Our job was on Singapore. Gordon Bennett was lagging it.
So Chamberlain just wanted to obey orders?
Oh, yeah. In his way, it was the same thing. He was an Australian, he was English. He don't want anything to do with him, you know. If he wants to be a coward and run away, let him run. That was the attitude of mind, you know. And I learned afterwards that he did actually run away, didn't he, Gordon Bennett?
What kind of mood did he seem to be in when you were escorting him?
No, you know, it's dark time, you don't see him. You know, all we got was a message to, if we wanted to go with him, we could do. Apparently he left with a few more people and he was the only one that survived. Don't know. But the biggest shitbag of the lot was Wavell. And Churchill, of course. The old man was... Our old man, that is, Eb Holmes, received a memo, and it was signed PM, which I assumed to mean Prime Minister. And it was a teleprinter or typewritten memo. And on it was the words that Wavell had used, that there was too many men in the back areas, too much movement in the back areas, and there was nobody up front meeting the Japanese, and that we must all fight till the last man, and the officers must die at the side of the men. But take heart, soon the skies will be black with planes. That was his last message. And the skies were black with planes. The only thing was they were Japanese bloody planes, not British. That's why, you know, most of the lads, a lot of them now, they'll say, oh no, Churchill was a great guy. But then, they detested him. They hated his guts. And I had not changed my opinion. That man knew everything that was on in Singapore. He knew everything about Singapore and Malaya. I think Mr. Churchill knew bloody well that all that Singapore had been used for was to try and draw the, or to know that it would draw the Americans into the war so he could use their facilities in Europe. He had no interest in the empire at all. He wanted to be the big man that won the war against Hitler. And I don't believe half of the memos of his that I've read. I've read one or two of the books that have been written, supposed to have come from him or his memos, and they're a load of bullshit. You know, things don't stay immaculate, or they didn't then. Nowadays, yes, we keep a record, an immaculate record by computer, you know, typewriter, this, that, and the other. In those days, they weren't kept so meticulously. And I don't believe that half of the things that have been said that he's supposed to have done, I don't think they're true.
Now, I interrupted you with you talking about the soldiers looting on the 15th of February. Can you take the story further?
Yeah, it wasn't only the 15th of February. It started... Well, it started well before that. When the Japs had started the war, when the war had been on, we'd lost the Prince of Wales and the Repulse, and we'd lost several actions. They sent the 18th Div in with pickaxe handles. So what happened was that there was more men than what we got rifles and ammunition or weapons. So much so that what happened then was that you could find rifles anywhere in the street, rifles and bayonets, machine guns, Tommy guns, stuff like that. And any lad who hadn't got one, he'd just go and pick one up out the street where others had left them. They just didn't give a cuss. They'd come down from Malaya. You know, they'd had the stint at fighting. They'd come down, they was in the streets of Singapore, and they just threw whatever they'd got away. And they just got lost. And from, I would say around about the 7th, maybe a bit before, maybe after, I don't know. But from the 7th of February onwards, you couldn't walk in Singapore without falling over a soldier. And he was either drunk, frightened, demoralised, gloating with what he'd got, his loot. You know, they weren't fighting. I mean, there was nobody to fight. But they weren't got together, they weren't banded together, you know. To me, it was a complete and utter shambles. We had Navy men who'd been picked up out of the sea, been blasted. They were coming ashore, being equipped with army equipment, and they were doing more, you know, with rifles and bayonets, and they were going up fighting the Japanese. And yeah, we got these others, but it's not their fault. They hadn't been trained. You know, there were some of them, they hadn't even been sunburned. And they just didn't know what to do. They hadn't a clue what to do. All they knew was that everybody down there was enjoying themselves. They were boozing, they were looting and stuff like this. So they went and joined them. I'm jumping the gun a little bit. But to give you some ideas, when the war finished and we had to go around afterwards, volunteers were called for to go around collecting live ammunition and dead bodies, as they called it. I came across a field, and in that field was something like 230 dead men. In the middle of the field, where the rifles were stacked, 5 or 10 to a stack or whatever. And at the far end was a cookhouse. The rain had had it, the weather had had it, but originally there was a cookhouse there, and blokes were being fed a meal. All these others were laid down having the meal or sat around waiting to go for their place in the queue. The queue was there, everything. The only thing that was missing, there were no lookouts, there were no sentries. This was one complete, I'd say more than one, possibly two complete companies of the Norfolk Regiment, wiped out, sat down having the dinner. They hadn't a bloody clue. They didn't know what it was about. You know, you've got all these people talking about we run away or this, that and the other. A man can only play football if he's taught how to play. He can only play chess if he's taught how to play. If he isn't taught, then he just doesn't know. And that's what it was with these fellas. And as I say, that after the war, this is what I found at one particular spot. And that was just, I would say it'd be about 300 yards from Bukit Timah Racecourse, where that had happened. And there wasn't a lookout or a sentry. Well, what I'm saying is, there was no dead bodies where a sentry would likely have been posted, or a lookout. And this was roughly about the 9th, 10th of February when this happened. The Japanese had invaded. They got onto Singapore. And there was no officers capable of saying, look, get somebody watching all these bloody cars. And bullets are flying all over the place and bombs and stuff like this. But there was nobody with the intelligence to say, you know, put posters out, put men out. Other than that, why erect a bloody kitchen in the middle of the dunes? Stupid. You know, why they did it, I don't know. But they were dead. And there was over 200 of them in that one particular camp. And that's the type of fiasco that Singapore was. And it was a fiasco. Well, from there, I went back into, as I say, the swimming club, where all this started, where you could see all the bottles and everything being thrown about. And the place was absolutely stinking with drunken people and the stench of spirits. If anybody had dropped a match, the whole lot would have gone up in flames. And that was when Major Cooper came in and wheeled all the monsters out, drunk or sober. He was a soldier. You know, he knew how to control men, how to handle them. And they got the lot of us out. Some of them he kicked up the backside. Literally kicked them up the backside out of the place. And we was all taken back then to the pineapple factory. And then for some reason or other, we stayed the night in the pineapple factory. The Japanese issued an instruction that everybody was to go back to the place where they were when the fighting stopped. Which meant that we, not actually to the gun positions, but to the red quarter positions, which put us back in the school in the centre of Singapore. And we had to regroup then, for wait for orders as to where we was going to go. And the order came through that on the morning of the 16th, that we was to march up into Changi, Changi prison. Not the jail, but Changi camp, which is at the north end of Singapore. Normal times, you'd walk that in, I'd say it'd take you about 3 hours, comfortable 3 and 4 hours walking. So most of them tried to march it, but it was no good, because marching is different to walking. And a lot of them were really foot weary and sore. But fortunately, we had Ebb Holmes, who was a CO, who forgot tradition. We marched out of the school until we got to Geylang Road, and it's walk along, lads, and we walked We didn't march, no singing, dancing, anything like that. And we just walked it from there into Changi. Now, when we got into Changi, we was put in the Manchesters, were placed in the farthermost billet, the farthermost barrack block of Changi, straight up on the water between Johor and Singapore, you know, the main drift there. And with beautiful view, we could see all the Johor at one side and all the sea, and look out to Pulabuckan and Pulabrani, Blackamatti, all the different islands, you know. And we could look out and see all the all the area around us, all the sea and everything is beautiful. But it wasn't appearing to us at that time. You know, we'd landed in there on the 16th of February. And the position was now that with no food, with no running water, because all the reservoirs had all been digged up by the Japs. Every toilet in the place, well, had been the toilet, was absolutely full of shit and everything else. There was no bedding or anything like that. So it was a case of dog-eat-dog. And you got roughly about 50,000 men walking around Singapore, around Changi, an area which normally held 5,000 men. And you're bumping into one another, pulling over one another, looking for something. You don't know what you're looking for until you find it. It's either a blanket, or part of a charpoy, or a string to make a charpoy, but you was looking for something. If you found a football, you'd found something that might come in useful, so you put it on one side. Well, I was, at that time, as I say, I was young and bloody stupid and daring. And I was with three more lads. We decided that we'd go further afield. Our boundary was the Changi perimeter itself. You couldn't go any further than that. Well, where our machine gun post was at the north extremity of the beach was just outside our camp. And I don't know why, in my mind, I thought if I can get there, I might find something useful and we might be able to get away from here. So we went over towards the gun post. And it's, to explain it, you're on them grassy, sandy hillocks, just somewhat similar to Southport, you know. And then all of a sudden, below the hillocks, it just runs out of an expanse of sand with the sea running the side of it, a terrifically long beach. And that long beach, possibly you'd see, three huts at the most, and the rest was palm trees and such. And then over to the right was the main road that we'd just come along. And as we was going along there, we knew, we'd been told that if we sat pound outside Changi, we was dead. The Japanese would execute. And as we was going along, we could hear these trucks coming up the road. And we thought they were our trucks, bringing more men in. So we just hung about where we were. And then we saw that they were actually our trucks, but with Japanese driving them. And they drove, some of them got stuck out. So they backed onto the beach, opened the backs down, dropped the backs. There'd be about 8-9 trucks. Dropped the backs, and out tumbled all these Chinese men, women, children, you name it. And they were all roped together, wired together, tied together, all in groups, some individual, some in two, some in three, some in groups of 10. And they were just literally pushed out of the wagons and told to get down towards the sea. And they bundled them all down there. And at a guess, going back now, I'd say there'd be about 300 to 500, don't know. And then they just put the machine guns on the beach and just blasted the lot away.
Did you see all this?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yes. And then later on, there was another pile of trucks come up from the back road and they did the same again. And time was getting on. You know, we'd marched all the way from Singapore and we was weary and tired. We'd not taken any notice at the time. And we couldn't export ourselves. We couldn't go back to Changi in case we were seen, so we had to stay where we were. And then they brought this other lot in, and they did the same with them. They machined them the lot.
And how many Japanese were involved in this?
Oh, various. In the first lot, you got your 9 drivers and possibly about 30 or 40 men, including officers, were they shouting and chanting and screaming at one another what to do and all this, that and the other. And then the second lot was about 6 or 7 wagons, and the same again. and they did exactly the same. And then the Japanese, while we stood there, were going amongst them to see if they could find any bits and pieces of, you know, anything useful.
Did any of the Chinese try to escape?
Oh, they were dead. Didn't get a chance to escape. There was only two escaped. And that was when the Japanese got back on the wagons. They were going away. And we went to scavenge as well to see if we could find anything. And as we was going through these, all these, was, I don't know whether it was just us being, what do you call it, when you go looking at dead people.
Ghoulish?
Yeah, I don't know, it was us being that. Because we were by now hardened to death, you know, we knew what it was all about. But at the same time, we wanted to see, I would imagine, what other people looked like dead. We'd seen Englishmen dead, you know, one or two of the outfits. And as we were going through, there was an arm moved. And one of the lads went over and started shouting to us and went over, and it was a Chinese, and he was still alive. He'd been shot in the arm. So we pulled him out. And there was another one, was a Eurasian. And we, both of them were took back to Changi, and they were enlisted in the British Army. They went in about 16th, 17th of February when we took them back.
So you just pretended they were soldiers?
They did. We didn't want them. You know, as far as we was concerned, we took them with us. As far as where they... It was like a barbed wire, what do you call it, piece of wood with wire on which you slid across the road back and to stop people going in and out. And what we did was got them into there and hand them over to the bloke that was on guard at the time. We had our own guards, Englishmen. But as I say, we'd got these two out, and then we found what we wanted was bits of cloth, which some of the people were wearing. You wouldn't find any watches, jewellery or anything like that. The Japs had already taken that. We found a charpoy bed with other bits and pieces that we might need, you know, and we took back with us. And
so the Japanese just left the beach littered with the corpses?
Oh, yeah. They were there for, well, days and days and days after. But eventually prisoners went out and shifted them. We had to go, not us, not me personally. I was on other jobs. But the prison force were sent out and they had to go out there and literally just put them all together and set them on fire. The Japanese poured petrol over them. Well, they didn't, but they gave us the petrol to pour over the people, over the dead bodies, and just set fire to them.
Did you understand why the Japanese had massacred them?
I had no idea, other than that they hate Chinese. There's always been that hatred between them. But the Chinese and Japanese were always at one another's throats. But to me, you know, I was only thinking that they were the masters. They were the same as we were in Palestine. They were the bosses. They did what they wanted to do, and that was